This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, August 13th. I'm Eric Latch, staff writer at The New Yorker, filling in for Dorothy Wickenden. On Tuesday, Joe Biden announced his running mate, California Senator and former presidential candidate Kamala Harris. This wasn't exactly a surprising choice. Harris had been rumored to be the frontrunner for the spot since almost the moment Biden clinched the nomination this spring. And in fact, there had been talk of a potential Biden-Harris ticket going back to last year. But the choice was significant nevertheless. Biden, if elected, would be the oldest president in history, and he has described himself as a bridge figure and hinted that he would only serve one term. Harris has long been considered among the politicians who would help define the Democratic Party's future. Now she might do it from the perch of the second highest office in the land. The stakes are high, as Harris herself pointed out in her first public appearance with Biden this week.
We need more than a victory on November 3rd. We need a mandate that proves that the past few years do not represent who we are or who we aspire to be. Joe likes to say that character is on the ballot, and it's true. When he saw what happened in Charlottesville 3 years ago today, he knew we were in a battle for the soul of our nation. And together with your help, that's a battle we will win.
Dana Goodyear, a New Yorker staff writer who profiled Harris last summer, joins me to discuss how Harris reached this milestone, her track record in California politics, and what her selection means for the future of the Democratic Party. Dana, welcome.
Thanks so much.
Many people listening are probably familiar with Harris from her time in the Senate in the last few years, where she sort of made a specialty of making Trump administration officials sort of sweat in hearing rooms. And they might also sort of know a bit about her background. She's the daughter of a Jamaican economist and an Indian cancer researcher who came to the States for graduate school. But the bulk of Harris's career as a prosecutor in California is less sort of publicly well known. And that was a big focus of the work that you did in the piece that you wrote last summer. And I was wondering if we might start there and just talk about where Harris is coming from and how she came up and how her career got going.
Yeah, I think it's really significant that she got her start as a sex crimes prosecutor, and that has been emerging as a theme of her political persona, which is to say, very, very direct questioning of Justice Kavanaugh and his confirmation hearings, very clearly saying, we have a sex offender in the White House, and I'm trained to go after people like that, and I'm going to. And like any good prosecutor, she's incredibly well prepared. She has in Biden somebody who is perhaps a little bit looser than she is. And when you think about Trump, he's dangerously spontaneous. And she's neither of those things. She's somebody who probably has, you know, 10 legal notepads full of notes for every press conference that she gives or, you know, set of remarks she makes. She's careful and diligent. So I think that is a huge asset right now.
Yeah. And in particular, I mean, she becomes a prosecutor in a very specific context, which is the world of San Francisco politics, not just California, but specifically San Francisco politics. And that's where she starts going from just a public prosecutor into an elected official. Now that she's incontrovertibly a national figure, sort of what are the aspects of San Francisco politics that explain different ways that she goes about her work?
Well, I think one thing that interests me is the whole way that progressives have responded to her and her response to their response. And she, in her telling of her own story, really focuses on how her parents met in the civil rights movement and free speech movement in Berkeley. And this feels to her like, you know, that was her cradle and that was her upbringing. And she was surrounded by Black activists and thinkers. And even though her parents split up when she was pretty young and her father moved to Palo Alto, her mother stayed in Berkeley and raised Harris and her sister Maya in the Black community as Black women. Maya, who played a significant role in Kamala's campaign, she was the director of the ACLU for Northern California. So she is the sort of in the streets activist, and Kamala's approach has always been to have a seat at the table. And it's fun to imagine their kind of sisterly dynamic, but I
don't. Yeah, inside outside.
Inside outside. You know, do you want to be banging on the door? Or do you want to be at the table making decisions? And Kamala obviously chose the latter route, but that has caused her some pain, and I think caused her some pain in the primary season.
Yeah, so this was a thing that came up a lot when Harris was herself a candidate for the Democratic nomination. The left being very skeptical of Harris's record as a prosecutor and skeptical of prosecutors in general as people who could pick up the progressive mantle at this moment. How did she try to have that conversation? What was her response to that?
Well, I think it's even more than her time as a prosecutor, but when she became DA of San Francisco, which is, you know, it is a very progressive county, but like many progressive places, there's a culture clash between what the politics of the people are and what the policing culture is. So that was true in San Francisco as well. She approached that role in what she would say was a progressive way. But the changes that she made when in that role were incremental, were small. The bail reform movement has a big problem with her now taking any credit for or making comments about the eradication of cash bail, given that she historically upheld the high bail schedule in San Francisco. So, but she did do some diversion programs, and she did reach out to young activists, particularly people working with sex workers and trafficking victims. And I think that you can see that line from her work as a sex crimes prosecutor and somebody who thought of herself as really protecting children to even some of the most absurdist sounding, harsh programs like the threatening parents of truant kids with jail time. I think she viewed that as very consistent with her idea of protecting children and creating equity through our public education system.
And now she's in a position where her criminal justice platform for her campaign was in a number of notable ways, thinking about like cash bail or marijuana legalization, like to the left of where Biden, like her, now she's on the ticket with Biden and in a way, sort of on the left of the top of the ticket. A big question out there is going to be, is she going to stick to the platform that she advanced in her primary campaign? Or is she likely to just kind of say, okay, like Biden won, Biden's the top guy, and this is the platform as it is?
I think it kind of depends on, and I think this will emerge soon, what kind of strategic use the Biden folks want to make of her, because she can presumably turn out Black women voters who might have felt really frustrated and betrayed in this moment if the VP pick had been a white woman. So it depends on whether you think Biden has a clear strategy with the Black vote at this point. I mean, in the primary season, it saved him and it made him the candidate. But the general election will be different. And I think that in the last couple of days since Kamala was picked as VP, you've seen a real muzzling of the progressive voices that said Kamala Harris is a cop. Most people have seemingly decided to notice the ways in which she's more like them than she is different in terms of social justice, in terms of criminal justice reform. So,
and how do you think, I mean, how do you think Harris, she gets elected to the Senate on the same day that Donald Trump wins the presidency. But she was expecting to come to Washington as kind of like a supporting player in a kind of like governing coalition with Hillary Clinton as president. And instead, she kind of became a kind of resistance figure and sort of figure out like what the Democratic Party was going to be. How do you think she views her role in the Democratic Party and what it's going to become?
That's an interesting question, because I think that for her, she's now supported in being as progressive as she always felt. I mean, I think in a sense, she doesn't acknowledge that the arguments made by the far left about what she could have done when, and her point is, I got in the room and now I'm doing the things that I got in the room for. So I think she's really only a centrist when you average in her past. When you look at her Senate career and what she said as a presidential candidate, she's pretty solidly progressive.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
Just in terms of electoral strategy here, presumably part of the calculus for the Biden campaign is that Harris can speak to Black voters and other members of minority groups in the country in a way that Biden has had trouble doing recently and also through the course of his career. How do you see the kind of tactics of this pick for Biden?
Yeah, we talked about what effect it might have on really solidifying with Black voters the Biden ticket. I think it's really interesting that Trump is so sure that quote-unquote suburban moms or suburban women are going to be threatened by a Kamala Harris. I think she's enormously relatable to that population, potentially. Obviously, he will do as much race baiting as possible. And I think we see his early out of the gate kind of remarks about how offensive she was to Biden. I mean, it's such an odd thing for him to say that she's bad because she was mean to the guy who just picked her. But anyway, I think he's trying to engage the sympathies of his presumed, you know, stronghold of voters. And I don't think that that's necessarily effective. I mean, I'm just not sure that her history as a prosecutor and someone who protected children and sent violent criminals to jail is going to be upsetting to the so-called suburban stay-at-home mom that Trump keeps invoking when he says what a bad choice Kamala was. I think it could end up being useful to Biden with those college-educated women to have such a smart woman by his side, somebody who's never going to misspeak, never.
Yeah.
She's just not going to do it. And she's incredibly personable. It's something that Biden is known for as well, but she is known as an excellent retail politician.
Right. And fundraiser.
Yes. And I think there was just a lot of competition in the presidential primary, and there were a lot of fascinating, charismatic, never seen before this type of candidates. So I think it was just sort of a tough field. But I think that she will draw on those strengths, the kind of the hand selling. And she's really quite good at that.
Yeah. Suddenly there's this explosion of enthusiasm in the Democratic Party for Harris this week. But her campaign really fizzled last year. I mean, I spoke to a lot of voters last year in early voting states where people would say, I like her, but I don't think she can win. You know, that there was a lot of like that feeling among voters, like, well, I would vote for her if everybody else wanted to vote for her, but I just don't think everybody else is going to vote for her. And the subtext of that was that, you know, she just wasn't the kind of figure because of her background and her identity that could win.
But didn't people say that about Obama, too?
Well, it's and your piece, one of the most interesting things, I think, in your piece is her relationship with the Obama story, the ways in which Obama provides a model for kind of talking to voters about that mindset and getting them to get past that. But also, obviously, and understandably, a kind of resistance at, you know, just being like another Obama, you know, being described as another Obama.
Well, I also see that as a gender thing. I mean, no woman wants her life to be encapsulated and contextualized only by the life of a man who has done it first. I mean, I think she very rightly considers herself a groundbreaker. So, you know, she would be fine probably with other people being called the male Kamala Harris, but she doesn't want to live in Obama's shadow. I think, though, that his story does create a template, and certainly they've been close for years. I think it also, as I pointed out in that piece, it created a template, which it's still going on now. It's only going to get worse in the next several months, but the birtherism template is a real template too, the resistance to a figure like her. But I think that having a shorthand for someone when you're dealing with the general public who's just trying to figure out what everyone's all about is probably somewhat useful, but it really bases her appeal in identity politics. And I think her appeal is broader than that.
So what do you expect in the next, there's like 2.5 months until Election Day. You know, what are we going to see Kamala Harris doing? I mean, she'll debate Mike Pence, which will presumably be a big event. And what else might we see from her in the weeks ahead?
I think she's going to be incredibly busy. I mean, I think she's going to go out there and she's just a worker. She's just going to get out there. She's going to connect with the Black voters in South Carolina who so, you know, she never had the momentum there, but I think now she will. I think that she's going to be very, very, very tough on Trump. I don't know what she really is going to say about Mike Pence. I mean, I honestly can't think of much to say about him myself, but I think that her target is Trump. Her target is Trump as a criminal, and she is a prosecutor. So I think we're going to see her come through as somebody who is really radiating competence, and that's going to be very reassuring. And everyone, when there's a basement party that gets out of control, actually feels secretly relieved when the parents come home and turn on the lights and say, everybody go to bed. I think that's what she's going to do.
Dana, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Dana Goodyear, a New Yorker staff writer, is the author of 2 collections of poems, Honey and Junk and The Oracle of Hollywood Boulevard, as well as the book Anything That Moves. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for newyorker.com. I'm Eric Latch, filling in for Dorothy Wickenden.